From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, the nomination of Governor Janet Napolitano to be the next head of Homeland Security could mean some real changes in Arizona politics. We'll hear more in a report from Christopher Conover. A mountain was the site of the earliest known human settlements in the Tucson Valley. Today, plans are in place to rehabilitate the birthplace of Tucson, as Kimberly Kraft reports. The StoryCorps mobile recording studio has arrived in Tucson, a unique opportunity to preserve memories and share family stories with the world. I'll talk to Sarah Ezrick from StoryCorps to find out more about their mission and how Tucsonans can participate. And Claudine LaMonaco introduces us to another storyteller from the Miner's Story Project. That's all coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. Every cabinet choice announcement from President-elect Barack Obama has received its share of scrutiny. Analysts are eager to examine how each appointment could affect policy in the new administration. The choice of Governor Janet Napolitano to head the Department of Homeland Security is one that promises to bring some political change here in Arizona. We'll hear more next from Christopher Conover.
When Governor Janet Napolitano accepted the nomination as Homeland Security Secretary, another chapter of Arizona history began. Governor Napolitano joined Senator John McCain as a top name in Washington, and Arizona Secretary of State Jan Brewer steps into the governor's office for the remaining 2 years of Napolitano's term. When they assume their new roles, both women are faced with huge problems. University of Arizona political scientist Dr. John Garcia says Napolitano is taking over one of the largest agencies in federal government.
Given some of the past experiences, I'm thinking, like, particularly not just in terrorism, but on FEMA, that it's like, if you can make any improvements, you know, it's like the magnitude of that paying off maybe multifold, because of just either low expectations or just a very, very negative past record. So, like, it's like the bar may not be that high in terms of demonstrating that you've done some things better than your predecessors.
And the state is currently facing a $1.2 billion budget deficit. And next year's budget is also expected to experience shortfalls, and that will fall onto Brewer's plate.
The legislature, I think, has already kind of given some indication that what areas of the budget are likely to be experiencing major cuts. And I think education has been on the block for some time, and I think now K-12 is apparently real vulnerable, as well as higher ed. And so the question becomes, in this case, is Jan Brewer sort of mirror those sentiments in the legislature, or she takes somewhat of a different position, and how does she work through that? Because here you're talking about a governor who shares the same party affiliation as the legislative leadership.
Governor Napolitano's nomination also creates a lame duck situation, because she says she's not resigning until after she's confirmed by the Senate, something that won't take place until after January 20th. Which means she'll oversee state budget decisions until then. As a lame duck, the Republican-led legislature could simply choose to not deal with the Democrat Napolitano and wait until their Republican colleague Jan Brewer takes over. But Dr. Garcia says that's a dangerous gamble.
If it's as grave as what they're saying, then there's also some repercussions biding your time.
State and local officials traditionally at this point on the calendar are planning for the annual legislative session, which this year will begin on January 12th. Complicating that is the fact that Napolitano will still be in charge at that point, and then within weeks will hand over the reins to Brewer. Richard Elias, the chairman of the Pima County Board of Supervisors, says he's not looking forward to the change at the top.
I think it's going to be probably one of our most challenging times in recent history due to the huge budget deficit that we have, difficult relations with Governor-to-be Brewer. The legislature has taken a turn to the more conservative side of things, which would play into Governor Brewer's ideology as well. So I think it's going to be a real challenging time. We look forward to seeing the Southern Arizona legislators stick together and try and make sure that Pima County and the jurisdictions within Pima County are treated fairly.
Longtime Arizona politicians and residents are used to secretaries of state stepping into the governor's office. It's happened five times, most recently in 1997 when Jane Hull took over for Fife Symington, who resigned after his conviction on fraud charges. And the University of Arizona's Dr. Garcia says Secretary of State Brewer should be able to make the transition fairly well.
She's an ex-legislator, an ex-county board of supervisors, so she's got a lot of experience in political office and also in sort of a quasi-executive kind of role. So I think the transition for her should be somewhat easier in the sense that she has more experience than say, other previous Secretary of State who succeeded departing governors.
As Governor Napolitano wrapped up her acceptance of the cabinet position, she turned her attention home.
It is difficult to leave one job for another, but one must go where one can best serve.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
The recorded history of Sentinel Peak, which is usually known as A Mountain, is also the history of Tucson. Long recognized as the site of the earliest human settlements in this area, A Mountain is still used as a gathering place, but not always officially. Area residents and city government are currently planning for the future of A Mountain, and there are hopes that the landmark can one day be restored to its natural splendor. Kimberly Kraft reports.
It is said Paleo-Indian and archaic hunters and gatherers crossed the Tucson Valley as early as 10,000 years B.C. Migrations continue to this day, and multitudes of cultures have put down roots.
It's just a nice place to live, and there's everything we need around here. All the amenities are right near here.
Retired from the military, Lee and Jean Page moved to Panorama Estates in 2003 and spent many leisurely hours enjoying their stunning view. But even paradise has its price.
When they closed the gates on A Mountain in the late evening, then people started coming to Panorama Circle and parking here and partying right in front of our house, right on the street down there. And we would find beer bottles and beer cans and food wrappings and all kinds of other unmentionable things on the street down there, and we'd have to clean it up the next morning.
Civilization began at the base of Sentinel Peak when somewhere around AD 200, native migrants became agrarian residents where the Santa Cruz River used to run all the time. Father Eusebio Kino, a Jesuit priest, established a European presence in 1699, and migration continues to this day. Now Tucson's population numbers 1 million inhabitants, and where civilization began, at times, incivility has prevailed.
For many, many years, we have not invested in it. It is a regional park that is used by the entire community. But yet at the same time, we really have not gone back to A Mountain and Sentinel Peak and invested in it.
As the Rio Nuevo redevelopment machinery mitigates the territory at the base of Sentinel Peak, which the city trashed literally in the 50s by turning the property into a landfill, local thought plans to restore the convento and gardens at the original site, and naturally, eyes have turned upwards. The goals of the Sentinel Peak Park plan are to increase safe access, restore the natural environment, improve trails, provide shade, and interpret Tucson's history. The city has approximately $130,000 to spend on Phase 1 improvements that will focus on safety and improved access. The city and county are also supporting a $2.5 million bond that they will ask voters to approve in 2009 or 2010. The master plan will guide how to spend those funds to improve the park. Ward 1 Council Member Regina Romero inherited the project from her predecessor and feels proud to help the community to preserve what she considers a Tucson icon.
I happen to believe and agree that that investment is good for all of us, not only the residents of Ward 1, not only the people that we want to go up there and enjoy it, but the entire community.
Not all community members agree. Because of red ink in the city budget, those who make regular use of city parks have seen their access curtailed.
So it's not just a matter of coming here to have fun, although it is fun, and you meet a lot of keen people. But that's not the main motive. You know, if I am not able to do this, you know, I just hesitate to imagine that I would, you know, revert to what I was before.
Russell McGee used to spend nearly an hour every day water walking in Fort Lowell Pool until the facility, like two-thirds of Tucson's year-round pools, closed its doors for the winter as a cost-cutting measure. For McGee, who couldn't bend over nor tie his shoes 2 years ago, the pool has provided certain relief. He questions the decision to spend resources on A Mountain while at the same time closing city swimming pools and reducing operations at recreation centers.
It isn't clear to us why this going concern should be put out of business in preference to improving a property that seems to have been abused.
Romero has heard this type of discussion before. In times of economic stress, people often question civic expenditures, but she points out the A Mountain Plan began years ago and predates the budget red ink that has resulted in recent cost-cutting measures.
So it's not like we can take from A Mountain to give to a pool. The process has been, the money has been allocated, the planning has happened already, and it's happening. We cannot pit one important element of investing in our community with another.
Romero feels the investment in A Mountain will pay off by restoring habitat, reducing erosion, and making the park more friendly for families and visitors. Page agrees.
Something this close to downtown, how can it go wrong? I'd think the city of Tucson would really appreciate that.
The process of civilization continues as we reshape this environment that has evolved over the centuries. The city invites comments from old-timers and newcomers. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Kimberly Kraft.
We'll have more Arizona Spotlight for you right after this break. Welcome back to Arizona Spotlight. The motto of the nonprofit group StoryCorps is simple but profound. Listening is an act of love. Since 2003, thousands of people from across the nation have had an opportunity to visit one of the mobile StoryCorps recording booths and have a conversation with someone they love. The stories that result bring to life the humor, the courage, the trials, and the triumphs of an astounding array of voices. A StoryCorps mobile booth is here in Tucson right now. It's located downtown in front of the main library. I visited with the StoryCorps team as they began collecting the stories from our friends and neighbors in Tucson, and I talked to them about their work. First, I met with the site supervisor, Sarah Ezrick.
I've lived in Seattle for the past 15 years, and I listened to public radio, and I heard StoryCorps on the radio, and every time stopped and listened, and like everyone else, it really evokes emotion and just thought. And I thought, how could I get involved? And I got on the website, and I saw this position, and applied and didn't really expect to hear anything, and then I did, and so I packed up my life in Seattle. I'd been a high school teacher and quit my job and rented out my house, and here I am for the year.
How much have you been traveling so far?
We travel every 3 to 6 weeks. So started the beginning of July, flew to Brooklyn for training, and then we went to Laramie. From there, Denver, and then Grand Junction, and then Grand Rapids, Minnesota, Peoria, Illinois, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and now here we are.
This is a question I've really got to ask, because I think when people think about StoryCorps, one of the main things that comes to their mind is the emotion that they hear on the radio and the emotion that it evokes in the listeners. Mm-hmm. How do you yourself
deal with that? I feel it too, often. I mean, if something is really touching, I often get teary, and then afterwards we talk about it. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like it's hard to avoid feeling emotional yourself. I mean, I don't break down, but definitely I am touched by a lot of the things I've heard.
And have you heard real revelations come out, family secrets be revealed at these?
There definitely are times where people will say, wow, I didn't even know that about you. And they've been their mother and daughter. So, definitely things come out that people haven't heard before.
Next, I spoke with Chayla Herridge-Meyer. She's one of the two facilitators with the StoryCorps team, and I asked her about her involvement.
I have been involved in StoryCorps for about a year and a half. I used to work in the offices in New York and have been facilitating for about 6 months now, 5 or 6 months. And I first heard about StoryCorps on NPR, and then also Dave Isay, the founder, was doing some interviews on other radio programs, and I was really inspired by some of his interviews specifically about the work that StoryCorps was doing.
And this must be a really interesting way to travel and see the country.
Yeah, it definitely is, because we're learning about the cities that we're in directly through people's stories about their personal lives in the city. So you end up leaving a place like Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Buffalo, New York, with tons of little anecdotes and personal histories about the places we go.
Have you ever participated in a StoryCorps recording session yourself?
As an interviewer, yes. I've interviewed a friend and also my father.
What was the reason behind bringing them in?
Well, I hadn't ever sat down and actually interviewed either of my parents before. And one of my driving reasons was I don't have any recordings of any of my grandparents. They all passed away before I was born, and I wanted to have something that recorded my parents that maybe my kids could hear or my great-grandkids could hear, and also just to have an opportunity to sit down and ask my dad some of the questions. And I didn't have anything prepared, actually. I just came in, and we ended up evolving and talking about fishing in Alaska and meeting my mom and, you know, that kind of stuff.
So could you introduce yourself and tell us how you first heard and got involved with StoryCorps?
Well, my name is Carl Scott. I'm actually a mobile facilitator with StoryCorps. And interestingly enough, I had not heard of StoryCorps through the radio. I was actually told about it from a friend of mine. Once I did, though, I was absolutely enamored with all of the stories and just the direction that they were choosing to go, allowing normal people to feel important just by virtue of the lives that they've led.
First of all, explain the job description there. Mobile facilitator, what do you do?
As a mobile facilitator, it's actually my job, one, to make sure that any participant that comes in is comfortable, but secondly, I take care of all of the audio equipment. So then I place the microphones, we take care of a sound check, and we take care of the recording, because when people leave, they'll immediately have a CD that they can take with them and make as many copies of as they like.
What are some of the challenges you faced in terms of recording the interviews?
They're kind of varied, actually. I mean, there's always the technical aspect of machinery and whether or not it can be faulty, but then additionally, there are voice differences. So then we're recording in stereo sound so that we're separating both microphones, because then there could be someone who's whispering and then someone who's really boisterous, and being able to mix those sounds appropriately so that when they get the CD and take it home, they're not saying, oh, well, I heard every answer, but the questions are foggy. I don't even know what was being asked. So that probably is one of the major challenges. And then there's just like small stuff. Sometimes people get nervous. They'll tap on the tables or shake their legs and things of that nature. And then there's always the ability to make someone actually feel comfortable when they get a microphone in their face, because it's, in theory, it sounds very easy for someone to be able to come in and tell a story about their lives. But when they come here and they see the situation is as professional as it is, they kind of get a little bit nervous. They don't know what to say, whether or not we're looking for something in particular, because once you think about Library of Congress, NPR being affiliated, everyone's like, well, you know, I don't know if what I'm saying is going to make it on the radio. But we always try to make people comfortable enough to feel that it's more important that they get their story told and take home something that they want to listen to than it is they give us something that's broadcast quality.
I would only imagine that you've heard a lot of stories here that you're going to carry with you for the rest of your life.
Yes. Yes, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of inflection involved in this job. To take people who, especially a vast amount of our facilitators are in younger ages, and to take people to give them an opportunity to, one, travel the country and then spend an enormous amount of time listening to other people. Once you start traveling, you're kind of not really paying attention to your regular life. And I had a guy come in, and he was just about 10 minutes late on a Sunday. And I asked him why, and he's like, oh, well, I had to call my mom. Like, I call my mother every Sunday. I'm like, oh, yeah, I need to call my mother, you know? And now from then on, I've made it a normal thing. But it's just interesting to encounter other people and the situations that they place themselves in and really see yourself in them, which is the reason behind which when we first start this job, we talk to other facilitators who've had it, and they always say at some point in time, you're going to cry in the booth. And it's nothing that you can control. It's just you're going to be confronted with a situation that touches you in a way that you didn't know you were vulnerable.
Now here's a sample of one of the stories that the team recorded on their first day in Tucson. The subject is KUAZ supporter Dorothy Finley. She's interviewed by her friend Glenn Kerslake.
Well, you know, I also remember you telling me at one time about riding a horse, and you spent a lot of time on the ranch, and you actually worked on the ranch.
Yes, we did. We all worked on the ranch. We had to milk cows, and then it went from that to riding and herding cattle. And then we learned to run the horses. We raised horses, our own horses. And then we raised horses for the Polo people. And what we would do is you go out into the pasture and you have wild mares. And they have all been bred to our stallion. And but you watch them, and you learn where they're going to be, and then you go downwind of them, because if you go upwind of them, then they can smell you and they will take off and you can't catch them. But my brother and I would run them. Because he would go in ahead, and they would follow his horse, and then we would lead them into the corrals.
So you and Tom were catching wild horses.
Yes, we were.
On the ranch.
Once they were broken, then they would assign a certain horse to you, and then the horse was going to be sold. And all we had heartbreaking scenes to see the horses go.
StoryCorps will be in Tucson through December 21st, and then from January 5th through the 17th. While the first session is currently full, there could be some cancellations. Information about scheduling an interview is at 1-800-850-4406, or you can follow the link at KUAZ.org. You can also listen to hundreds of StoryCorps interviews online. The University of Arizona's Mineral Museum is home to the Miner's Story Project. It consists of interviews conducted with miners and their families about what life was like in the mining towns of the Southwest. Next, Claudine LaMonaco introduces us to the next storyteller from the Miner's Story Project.
My name is Lorenzo Gonzalez, Senior. Everybody calls me Cacho.
Lorenzo Gonzalez, or Cacho, was born in the 1920s in Miami, Arizona, but was raised in Bisbee, where he still lives. When Gonzalez was 16, he lied about his age to get his first mining job, but mining had long since been in his blood. In this first story, he talks about how his family came to the Arizona mines.
They all came from Mexico, you know, in the 1800s. My dad was... My dad came in with He was with Pancho Villa, and he when they fought there in El Prieta, he came over and settled here in Bisbee. And my mother came in. It was an 1800s too. They came in by wagon train through Nogales, and they settled in Gleason. So they started working the mines in Gleason. After that, she married my dad, and he was working here in Bisbee. My dad got killed here in the mines in 1930, and I was only 4 years old.
In this next story, Cacho remembers his first day underground and how he learned why every miner carries a sturdy metal lunch bucket.
The first day I worked down there, I had a lunch sack. I didn't know, you know, it was my first day. Miners just looked at me. They never say nothing. You know, that's the miners, you know. So we got to the working place, and they showed me how to start my carbide lamp and everything. And they all had lunch buckets and put them up there. I had a sack, you know. What are you going to do with that lunch? You know, I don't know. I saw a big rat, you know. Oh, God, look at that rat. And they said, well, yeah, they're kind of big. So I got a piece of wire, and I wrapped that thing around the pipe, you know. And I wrapped that thing up good and hung it there. At lunchtime, it came down. There was no lunch. They crawled up there, and they ate the whole thing. Yeah, the miners laughed. Yeah, dog, they laugh. They'll learn you, kid. They'll learn you. They gave me a little lunch, you know, and stuff. That afternoon, I went and bought a lunch bucket. Yeah, one of them good kind, too. Yeah.
Underground miners were often paid on a bonus system. Talented miners could often double or triple their wages if they tunneled through more feet of rock than the benchmark set by the mining engineer. Cacho worked in the mines around Bisbee for 43 years. In that time, he became famous for racking up steep bonuses. In this story, he talks about an extraordinary bonus he earned for building a hoist station, or large underground area to store materials and machinery.
I was what you call a bonus hound. You know, the more you work, the more money. You know? Double your check and stuff like that, you know. That's pretty good. One time I made a hoist station. Yeah. And they paid me by cubic foot. Well, at first you had to drive a tunnel in there. And then after you drove the tunnel, you had to start, you know, blasting it, making it bigger, higher, you know. And after you cleaned it all out, they came and measured it. Right here. And I had a son that was going, that was my second son. Yeah, he was going to the University of Arizona. And he needed a car real bad. So I told him, God, dog, we'll go out and see the cars after payday. But meantime, I finished this station. I got paid. I went to Douglas, and I bought a Volkswagen for him, cash. It was out of that paycheck. Yeah, that's quite a deal.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio, Arizona Public Media, and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood and Ginger Duran, with production assistance from Matt Felix. I'm Mark McLemore.